On today's episode of It's Always Something in Philadelphia, Alec and I will wrap up the first half of the season for the 500 Fighting Phils. Phillies had a good stretch to end the first half of the season heading into the All-Star break that finds them at 3.5 games behind the Mets for first place in the division. We will wrap up the first half of the season as well as tell you what to look for in the second half. We'll also recap the Phillies' most recent draft on Sunday night, I believe it was. The MLB draft took place. Phillies walked away with some exciting names. We'll get into a few of them, and don't get excited. You're not going to see them for a few years, but it doesn't mean we can't fawn over them now. We'll also continue the summer of Ben Simmons trade talk saga and see where we stand with that issue. Today's episode is brought to you by Viget, and here is the intro music by Harry DeMarco. Welcome to another episode of It's Always Something in Philadelphia, episode 34, the Roy Halladay or the 2009 Cliff Lee episode. Today is Wednesday, June 14th, 2021. I almost upended my own comment I was about to make. I realized as I was looking at the date that today is 7-14-2021, so kind of like multiple of sevens thing. It's not a palindrome. I don't know what you would call that, but it sure is cool, huh, Alec?
I believe it is cool. I think it's also Bastille Day today for those interested.
What's that, like French Independence Day or something?
Pretty much, yeah.
Nice. Well, happy French 4th of July to our friends over in France. I don't know if we have any listeners in France, but if we do, I don't know. There's probably some phrase you're supposed to say for Bastille Day, which I don't know. But congratulations, I guess. Well, Alec, it's been a few days since we last spoke, and since then, the Phillies have gone on a little bit of a hot streak. The Phillies ended the first half of the season with a road trip in Chicago as well as Boston. They went 5-2 on that trip, taking 3-4 from the Cubs and 2-3 from the Red Sox. The offense really came alive in those two series, specifically in the Cubs games. In which they scored 13, 15, and 8 runs in each of the wins. The game on Tuesday, July 6th, was pretty interesting because the Phillies had an 0-5 record following games in which they scored 10 or more runs. They obviously scored 13 in the previous game. They topped that by scoring 15. The offense kind of came alive. The team's getting healthy. And they had a pretty good stretch to round out the first half of the season.
Yeah, they really did. And they knocked down some pretty notable Phillies names while they were at it. Absolutely shredded Jake Arrieta for, I believe it was 8 runs in the first inning, capped by Andrew McCutchen's grand slam. They also went at Nick Pivetta on Sunday to close out the end of the first half of the season. And now they're finding themselves exactly where I think most of us think they should be at 44-44.
Yeah, it really is kind of the epitome of this Phillies team that they just are the epitome of average, record-wise at least. I don't know how I could possibly forget the Jake Arrieta shelling. Going into that game, I was treating it as if it was Game 7 of the World Series. Anybody who knows me know I have a strong disdain for Jake Arrieta. He was a disaster every time he pitched for the Phillies, and his tenure here was miserable. With that said, the Phillies came out and probably felt similarly to the way I did. First pitch of the game, Gene Segura lines like 108-mile-an-hour double off the wall, followed by a hit-by-pitch on Realmuto, a single by Bryce Harper, and then Andrew McCutchen in the four-hole hits a grand slam, which I was wondering if that – like how many times in history that's happened where the fourth batter of a game hits a grand slam. Literally the most perfect start you could have. I mean, there's not a start that's better than that. And it was against Arrieta, and he didn't get out of the second inning. I don't think he even got 5 outs. So it was good to see that happen. They also hit pretty well off Brandon Workman, who was another miserable acquisition the Phillies made last season. It was good to see that. And then the Pivetta game. The Pivetta game was a crazy game all around for the Phillies. Very diminished roster as a result of a COVID outbreak that the Phillies somehow managed to let happen in July of 2021 at this far into the pandemic. The Phillies have one of the lowest vaccination rates of professional sports teams currently. And as a result, they kind of felt the effects of what an outbreak can do to a team. Aaron Nola was not able to start that game on Sunday. Alec Bohm was the player that tested positive, and a few other players got put in COVID protocol. And it was just a very, very disappointing turn of events for the Phillies, looking to end the first half of the season on a high note and kind of just doing what they do best and disappointing us.
I don't really – there were a lot of reports that came out after the fact that relievers such as Brandon Kinsler were are pretty, like, anti-vaccinations and think that some of the injuries that they've suffered over the course of the season are because of vaccinations that happen to certain players. Even Didi Gregorius is somehow anti-vaccination, despite being, like, very high risk, as evidenced by him wearing a mask all of last season when other players didn't have to. He wore it in the field of play. But yeah, it just seems like the Phillies are kind of just an unmanaged mess when it comes to serious, like, world altering issues like this.
Yeah. And it's, you know, you can't mandate — athletes are not required to get the vaccine, and we can't sit here and say, hey, you have to get the vaccine. Their reasons for not doing so, though, I mean, you explained it. They're sheer idiocy. Like, Brandon Kinsler said that he had gotten it and he felt like he had to labor through a start later that week. Brandon Kinsler, you're also just not good. So that could play a part in it. Archie Bradley blamed an oblique strain on it. Matt Joyce blamed back issues on it. It's just like, not getting it is one thing, right? Especially when we've seen that it can absolutely halt this pandemic and halt the spread of this virus and get us back to our sense of normalcy. You know, the world has largely returned to a you know, normal schedule, if you will. Not getting it is one thing, but citing some conspiracy lunacy bullshit about how it's given you all these phantom injuries is not only irresponsible but stupid. And Matt Gelb wrote a great piece talking about the Phillies and the outbreak, and he talked about how the group always cites themselves as such a resilient bunch, and they're always able to, you know, kind of look adversity in the face and try to overcome it together. The issue is, this is adversity that they themselves created. Like, they are responsible for this misstep, this mishap that caused key players to be out of the lineup on a given day. And, you know, luckily, if it had to happen at any point, it happened when they're about to go on a week break. But we didn't get to see Nola pitch on Sunday in Fenway, where he's historically been very good. We missed Alec Bohm in the lineup. A couple other guys had to get taken out of the roster, put into COVID protocols. They had to scramble to get guys up to Boston for the game on Sunday. It's just, they just do it to themselves too often, on the field, off the field. That's really the theme with this team, is that so many of their issues are self-inflicted. And it's just like, they've created such a dislikable force around them. And it's not as if they're doing it, you know, in exchange for winning. You know, like, if they created a team that was, like, really dislikable and did a lot of things wrong and not popular with the fans and, you know, had suspect characters on the roster, but they were winning and they were running away with the division, all right, that makes sense. When they're doing that and they're sitting at 500, it's tough to keep defending these guys.
Yeah, see, that's the thing, is you could say that they were taking these risks all season long with sort of not getting up to the vaccination rate. I don't even think that's taking a risk, really, but an argument that we won't have on this pod. If it was at the expense of, you know, losing a few games, like, they could be in first place right now if it weren't for some of the protocols taking place, such as, like, players missing games, then okay. I mean, we could see it. We could also see a more dislikable, like the Odubel Herrera decision, for example, of keeping him on the roster. I think it would be more justified if he was good at his job, which he is not. There's just a buildup of a lot of questionable character issues, Sam Coonrod being another one. That if they were winning, I don't think we'd be talking about them nearly as much. I think I personally, and I know you would too, still be, you know, mentioning them here and there. But the fact that the team is 44-44 as opposed to like 50-38 makes a big difference here.
Yeah, and I agree. And I say this at the risk of sounding like a huge hypocrite, but it is the point of the podcast today, with the Phillies at least. And because I am sick in the head, and no matter what this team does to me, I will never stop following them and looking at them through a fan lens, and just talking about them as a baseball team and their performance on the field. So that's what we're going to do today. We got our little rant out of the way, the Phillies being irresponsible and ultimately, you know what, not costing themselves a game. I mean, they won the game in which they had to miss Nola, they had to miss Bohm. By the grace of God, Brandon Kinstler, of all people, started that game. It was a bullpen game, and they were able to get seven outs to close it from Ranger Suarez, who I can't think of anybody right now who is like more – has a better case as the savior of the season. Ranger Suarez has become like the impromptu closer, the high leverage guy in the bullpen. He's been fantastic. And, you know, the Phillies only really have him to thank for getting them out of that mess on Sunday.
Yeah. Stock's way up on Suarez right now. There's legitimate arguments for him to be the closer. If he's the closer for the rest of the season, I think the Phillies are screwed for reasons outside of Ranger Suarez, but him playing himself into a legitimate bullpen role. I mean, we saw last year, he was pretty rock solid in the middle of the bullpen, of the Phillies bullpen morass. And the year before that, even when he finally transitioned into a reliever role, sort of at the end of 2019, he was also pretty effective. So this isn't the most shocking thing, but it is really nice to see him continue to build upon, because he was a starter when he first got called up, and then him having to convert to a reliever because he wasn't as good as a starter. So him really locking into this reliever role, I think, is really valuable for the Phillies, and it gives them some stability in an otherwise turntable-esque bullpen.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the one thing about Ranger Suarez that I've noticed is that his composure and his demeanor on the mound is unwavering. I mean, he's cool as a cucumber. He's confident in his stuff, and it comes through. There was a situation on Sunday, the game which he closed out, two full counts, back-to-back guys, big moments of the game, guys on base. I think it was the last inning of the game, and he throws 3-2 changeups. You got to have a lot of confidence in yourself to throw that pitch and make it a good pitch, and both of them worked out. I'm pretty sure he struck out guys back-to-back. So he has been a blessing. Large factor into as to why the Phillies are still in play for this division. The division that everybody thought was going to be the best in baseball has not been. They only have one team above 500. That's the New York Mets, 3.5 games up on the Phillies. But guys like Ranger Suarez coming in and making an unexpected impact are a large reason why the Phillies still find themselves in this division. The first half was a tumultuous one for the Phillies. A lot of frustration, a lot of the same old stuff that we've seen from them the past few years, but they find themselves in an advantageous position moving forward that allows them to really have a shot at this division. Going into the second half of the division and coming up on the trade deadline, there are moves that will need to be made for the Phillies. The Phillies have the easiest remaining schedule in the entire MLB in terms of win percentage. Ironically, they had the hardest schedule in the first half in terms of win percentage. So the Phillies have no real excuse here to not really be in the mix for this division and make a real push to get into the playoffs, to win the NL East. They have a very easy path laid out in front of them. And it's just a matter of whether or not they're able to take advantage of it, but they will need some additional help, some in-season acquisitions likely. Dave Dombrowski has never been one to shy away from making big trades. So let's run down some trade targets we have here. Firstly, what need do you think should be addressed for the Phillies heading into the second half? What do you think is the most pressing need for them? And how do you think they do it?
Most pressing is a high leverage bullpen arm. preferably a closer, which you've definitely talked about off air. I figured, as I said on last week's episode, that they would kind of buy low into this team, but it's clear to them, for them to make any sort of like discernible movement up the standings, that just a rock solid closer in there or a setup man at least, and maybe Suarez be the ninth inning guy, is necessary just to get the bullpen into some sort of hierarchy and structure so that Joe Girardi cannot manage them out of the pennant race.
Yeah, the I agree. I think a solid arm at the back of that bullpen is the most important thing for them. There's one name that's being thrown around a lot. It is Craig Kimbrell. Another name is, what's his name? Aroldis Chapman from the Yankees. Each of these guys, Aroldis Chapman has had a down year. Kimbrell is having one of his better seasons of his career. I mean, he's been really, really good this year for the Cubs, even though they stink. Those are two guys that the Phillies would be lucky to get performance-wise. The issue with that is those two are going to cost a pretty penny. I think one player the Phillies should look into acquiring is Richard Rodriguez, the closer for the Pirates. He's a guy that kind of came out of nowhere, wasn't really expected to do much this season, and he's currently pitching to a 2.29 ERA. He has 12 saves. He's really exceeding expectations, and I think that's a guy that they could potentially get for a cheaper package than a guy like Chapman or Craig Kimbrell. So I would love to see them pursue a guy like that. The other guy is in addition to the starting lineup, or the starting rotation, rather. A lot of rumblings around Cole Hamels again. Missed all of last season with the Atlanta Braves due to injury. This season, looking like he's healthy. He's been working out for teams, and the Phillies are reported to have interest in him. They're going to his workouts. That would be a guy that I would love to see the Phillies bring back for a little reunion tour, even if he doesn't pitch to, you know, what we would like him to, Cole Hamels standards, I guess. I mean, he is in the twilight of his career. He would be invaluable for, you know, these young pitchers that we have, Zach Wheeler, Aaron Nola, to be able to learn from a guy like that who had success like he did throughout his career, a winner, a World Series MVP. Like, for them to have him working with them in the rotation, I think would make it worth it to sign him. And all it's going to cost is money. So I think if he's healthy, there's no reason not to go after Cole Hamels.
Yeah, I agree. He can't be much worse than Matt Moore, right? I think that's really what we're basing this off of. Now, Moore has had some solid rebound outings recently, but I think on the whole, fans are mostly disappointed with him, even as the 4 or 5 starter. So I think giving Hamels a try, it can't be worse than them sometimes shuffling Vince Velasquez out there every other platoon spot in like the 5th spot in the rotation.
I agree with you. I think the Cole Hamels reunion, all it's going to cost is money. If he's healthy, I think they have no reason not to go get him. The fun thing about Matt Moore, I'm glad you brought him up. He's been really, really bad this year. I'm pretty sure the Phillies are set 5-1 in the games he starts. Somehow.
I can't be right.
I think I read that on Twitter. Let's see if we can look that up.
I'm just going on his game log on Baseball Ref. This doesn't say if he started or not. This is just great content for the fans, I'm sure.
Matt Moore, game logs 2020.
See, some of these are relief outings though, and you can't tell.
Okay, I might have just completely made that up. Now look. You can see game start.
Where is it? Oh, you're right, yeah.
Innings. GS means game started. Yeah. 1, 2, 2-1, 3-1, 4-1, 5-1.
Yeah. By God, he's right.
I was correct. So after some searching, we found it. I am correct. Matt Moore in games he starts, the Phillies have won 5 of 6 of them. So I don't know. MVP of the season? Who knows? No, I'm kidding. He has been bad, and I would much rather watch Cole Hamels pitch. That would just be awesome. I mean, for sentimental reasons aside, like Cole Hamels, well, no, not aside. I mean, that's a huge part of it. Like having him come back here and pitch, end his career in Phillies pinstripes, I think would be fantastic. And I think that's something that pretty much everybody would be on board with.
I don't see how adding an arm on the cheap can usually be a bad thing, especially a starting arm. Like, what's the worst he turns out to be? Like a lefty specialist out of the pen by October?
Absolutely. Like, I mean, it doesn't make sense not to go get him. And I think it's a realistic chance they do. But yeah, that's pretty much all I have is trade deadline targets. I'm not really concerned with any position players. I think that I don't think the Phillies should make huge moves for anybody. Chris Bryant's a name that's talked about a lot, but he's a Scott Boras guy. He's going to get a lot of money in free agency next year, and I don't think they're going to pay him, and they're going to have to give up a lot to get him. Maybe if they could find a fringe outfielder, like a starter on a bad team that can play center, that would be fantastic. I really wish they had taken my advice at the beginning of the season and traded for Cedric Mullins and Kevin Gausman, because they are two of the best players in the MLB right now. But you know what? Hindsight is always 20/20. We'll see what the Phillies do at the deadline. I expect them to make some moves. I don't know how big they are, but this is anybody's division, really. And we'll see if they really make a legitimate push for it.
If you had to pick between the guys you just named, between Rodriguez, Chapman, Kimbrel, Cole Hamels, or a fringe outfielder guy, who would you say is the most likely to be in Phillies pinstripes?
The most likely? Probably Rodriguez. I think it's between Rodriguez and Cole Hamels. I don't think they're going to shell out that much for Kimbrel or Chapman. I think their best strategy is to kind of stand pat here with what they have and make a cheaper upgrade that hopefully will work out. So I think Rodriguez is probably the best bet there. Cole Hamels only because there will likely be a lot of other teams in play for him, and you never know who's going to offer what. But here's to hoping they're both here. Who would you say?
I was actually going to say Chapman, just if the price is low enough. But I would imagine the Yankees would demand a pretty penny for him, and his reputation would probably supersede that. But he's overall had a pretty bad year, and it seems like Dombrowski has taken the effort to buy distressed assets ever since he got here, namely Alvarado, who hasn't worked out, and Coonrod, who has been up and down. But they were namely guys who he was able to buy low on, and if that's the case for Chapman, I think the value prop he would try and strike on it.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, Chapman has had a down year. He very well – could be cheaper than we expect. So we'll see what they do. While we wait to see what new players the Phillies add to their team, they did already add some new players to the prospect pool with the MLB draft on Sunday night. And I just wanted to wrap up a few of them because I love prospects and I love getting overly excited about young guys coming into the system who we probably won't see for 3 years. But I think the Phillies had a pretty good draft. And I would love to get into it, Alec, if you'd have me.
Of course, yeah.
So the Phillies' first-round pick, they had the 13th overall pick. And with the way the draft was going, talent was falling. Khalil Watson was a name that a lot of people had pegged to go in the top five. Like, a lot of people had him as a first overall talent. He fell all the way past the Phillies, actually, to the Marlins. He was rumored to want a really big deal, signing bonus, all that sort of stuff. And for that reason, it seemed to scare people off. I'm disappointed the Phillies didn't take him when he was there at 13. But they did take a guy named Andrew Painter. He's a right-handed pitcher from Florida. He's a high schooler. He was a Florida commit. There's a lot to like about him. It's similar to the Mick Abel pick last year, back-to-back years in which they use the first-round pick on a high school arm, get him into the system. Young, some guy that already has a lot of talent. And that's a strategy that I really like. I'm definitely in favor of betting on upside as opposed to availability. I think it always makes sense to draft a prospect with more talent who may be a few more years away from the MLB, from being MLB ready, as people like to say, than drafting, you know, maybe a 2 or 3 year college pitcher who's a lesser prospect, not as talented, but kind of more available sooner, like ready to come into the MLB sooner. I think it always makes sense to get the better prospect, better player, and let them develop longer. That seems to be what they're going to do with Andrew Painter. He's 6'7", so he's pretty big. He's built similarly to Mick Abel, actually. So he can definitely fill out. He projects pretty well. he's got four really good pitches, which is exciting because you don't really see young guys with a good feel for four pitches. He's got a plus fastball. He's been up to rumored to be up to 99, definitely up to 97 when the Phillies scouted him. He's got a really, really nasty changeup. He's not as good as Mick Abel, which is not really saying much. It's not a bad thing necessarily for Painter because I think Mick Abel is going to be a star. The only thing that the one negative I think with Andrew Painter is his stuff. When people say stuff, nobody really knows what that means, but it means like spin efficiency and explosion out of the hand with his fastball, with his different pitches. He doesn't have great spin efficiency on his fastball. And as a result, it gets kind of squared up more than it should for being 97. But I think that's something that the Phillies will work on with him when they get him into the system. They have good PD guys down there. And, you know, I'm excited to see what he becomes. I don't quite know what his ceiling is. I don't know if he has a number one starter ceiling, but I like the idea of two high school arms in back-to-back years, getting to train alongside each other in the same system under the same developers and see what they have in him. So if they unlock some explosion with him, get some more spin rate stuff going, I think he's going to be a pretty solid pitcher. Well, do you have any thoughts on the pick with Painter?
I concur on the favoring high school prospects, especially with how much more advanced high school prospects are these days than they were, say, 10 years ago, even 5 years ago. Definitely making that shift is probably the right move, especially for a Phillies team that badly needs to replenish its farm system if they're going to be competitive anytime during the Harper JT era. Painter passes the name check also. Definitely when he's painting the corners, when he's older, that will definitely play well into the announcer's hands. And he's huge. And he's got really nice command over his four pitches. And he's got to me, what popped out was his smooth delivery. It just seems like he's really composed in there. His mechanics all are fine. And he looks like he belongs.
Yeah, absolutely. He's like I said, for a young guy, a high school guy to have four solid pitches, that's really good sign as he develops, because most top high school guys coming out really only have two solid pitches. I mean, they can throw the other ones, but they don't have really good command over it. They don't have good feel for it. So that's a good sign in itself. He was like the number one, him and Jackson Joby were the two top high school arms, I think. Joby kind of jumped ahead of him. I think Painter was a little injured this season, or he got banged up a little bit. But he's right up there as the top high school arm in the draft. And that seems to be the Phillies' MO the past two seasons, past two drafts rather. And, I like the pick, and I'm excited to see what he's able to turn into. The second pick for the Phillies in the second round, the 49th pick, which is funny because this guy was actually the 26th ranked prospect. They drafted Ethan Wilson from South Alabama, and he's likely a corner outfielder, could transition to like a corner infielder. He's not super fast. He is an elite hitting prospect. We were talking about it the other night in our group chat. He could already be the Phillies' best hitting prospect, which says two things. One, it says that he's absolutely elite at the plate. But two, it says that the Phillies' farm system is lacking in offensive talent. Aside from like maybe like a Stott, Johan Rojas, like there aren't very many guys down there who are primarily offensive prospects, which is an issue in itself. But getting a guy like Ethan Wilson at the 49th pick, it's great value, is a really good place to start with, replenishing that offensive talent. The one thing I like the most about Ethan Wilson is he does not swing and miss. He has very, very good command of the plate. His plate discipline is fantastic. He walks a lot, and he just, quite frankly, does not strike out very high. He has a very low whiff rate. He reminds me of Joey Votto a little bit. He stands really close on the plate. He chokes up on the bat sometimes. He wears the high socks. He's got the look, and his swing is very similar. Like, he's just up there fighting off pitches before he gets one that he really likes, and he drives it. He's got great pop. And that plate discipline, that's gonna play at the upper level. Being able to draw walks and hit for power is an elite skill set. And I'm really excited to see what he blossoms into.
I think that approach will play well, really, to the fans if he makes his way up to the big team, because we've seen a lot of hitters come through, especially the Phillies organization, who have horrible approaches, one of which still is on the roster. I think you know who I'm talking about. Michael Franco being one of the past. So having a guy who's really disciplined at the plate, especially one with plus raw power like him, that's a pretty good combo. We'll just see where he is in 3 to 4 years.
Yeah, I mean, that's the case with all these guys. You're not going to see these guys right away. Obviously, we know that's the case. That's one of the reasons why the MLB draft isn't as popular as some of the other sports. But, you know, it's still exciting to be able to get talented guys down the roster or down in the farm, because I do love watching them develop. I'm not going to go through all of the draft picks, because I'm not going to lie to you guys and say that I know something about all of them. So I'll just give you real quick two more that I really like. Jordan Veers, I don't know how to say his name. It's probably Veers. Left-handed hitting power outfielder from Texas. He was 17, so he's like one of the youngest players in the draft, at least. I don't think he was even on the top 250 list of prospects. I think that's just because he was so young. He's an Arkansas commit. I think if they had waited 2 years, he would be a first rounder. He's got crazy pop, and we'll see positionally where he sticks. And then the last guy I want to talk about is I believe it was actually the last pick the Phillies made. The one that I am maybe the most excited about for the Phillies is outfielder Logan Kearney from Troy University. Kearney he is definitely an upside pick, but his tools are absolutely off the chart. He has plus power, crazy athleticism, crazy fast hands, crazy quick hips. If you watch his swing, it reminds me a lot of Mookie Betts. If you watch Mookie Betts swing, he kind of explodes from his core with his hips through the zone and the bat follows. Kearney does that too. I'm not saying he is Mookie Betts, certainly, but the swing is very reminiscent, and we've seen, you know, that formula turn Mookie Betts into one of the best players in baseball. He's relatively new to outfield. He's a center fielder, and I think he's probably going to stick there because his athleticism, his speed is going to make up for a lack of defensive instincts, which I don't think are bad per se, but they're just not as developed as guys who have been playing the position for a long time. The only issue with Logan Kearney is bat to ball. He swings and misses a lot, so that's going to be something that needs to change in his game if he's going to evolve into what I think he could be. My hot take with Logan Kearney is that he is now one of two players that the Phillies have in their system, in their farm system, that has true five-tool superstar potential, the other being Johan Rojas. I think Logan Kearney, if he's able to, you know, get bat on ball more consistently, fix the swing and miss stuff, I think he really could be a superstar for the Phillies. And for them to have gotten him in the 10th round is exhilarating. So all in on Logan Kearney.
I'm not going to act like I know who this guy is either. I had never heard of him until the Phillies drafted him. But I will say, based on the description that you gave, which is a very nice synopsis of the player, being a speed guy but not having great contact at the moment, probably not the best combo. That's definitely a foundational thing that it seems like the rest of Major League Baseball had their chances to take, and they just didn't. So maybe a lot of them were just betting on either him to be available for cheaper or just to not figure that part out. But the Phillies taking that chance, hey, this is what it's all about. You take a chance like that on a high upside guy like that, because if he does figure it out, he's a ridiculous talent like you outlined. So I got no problem with most of these picks.
Yeah. I mean, you never, you rarely ever see a guy with that kind of speed and power. And when you do, they're some of the best players in the game. He's hit 15 home runs this year, had an OPS north of 1,000. He also stole 12 bases. So that kind of speed, that kind of power like I said, the tools are off the charts. It's just a matter of whether or not the contact is able to develop and he's able to get to the point where he's consistently getting bad on ball. He's going to be a project guy, definitely, because there is a lot of development that needs to take place. But it's a guy that, if he figures out, I think the Phillies really, really are going to have something special with him. And overall, you know, I was a big fan of the draft. I trust Brian Barber, the Phillies director of scouting. He's been with the Phillies for 2 years now. And, you know, I think they are well on the way to replenishing what was a very depleted farm system for a very long time.
Who's your favorite prospect? Is it Kearney?
Probably Kearney. Yeah. Kearney or Ethan Wilson. I mean, Ethan Wilson is just going to hit baseballs all day. Kearney, I think, is going to be the most fun to watch, most fun to see develop. But yeah, I mean, I love them both. I'm very excited about both those guys and Painter too. I mean, first round pick, you got to be excited about that, and we'll see what he turns into. But talking about some guys with a new team, we'll talk about a guy who may have a new team soon. That would be one Ben Simmons. I think it's the second time I've used that transition today. Anyway, the summer of Ben Simmons trade talk continues. We got a report from, I think it was Shams the other day, that said the Sixers have opened trade talks with Ben Simmons, which is not groundbreaking, but it kind of opened the floodgates and all the rumors again. What is your latest opinion on what we've been hearing? Where do you think the Sixers stand with the Ben Simmons trade saga? What do you think the league stands with it?
I mean, like I said in episode 32, the solo one, the day after the Sixers lost to the Hawks, I thought the writing was on the wall already. I thought he was gone, especially since Morey tried to trade him for James Harden a few months ago. Yeah, I think none of this is surprising. The most surprising part, I think, is just that it's out there, and it has to be coming from either Rich Paul's camp or Daryl Morey himself. So either of those working themselves out, like, and getting it out to the forefront of the public is pretty surprising, especially since at the presser a few weeks ago, Morey was pretty neutral on the Simmons thing, even when Howard Eskin tried to, like, drill him specifically to answer that type of question. But overall, I none of this is surprising. I think the most surprising thing for Sixers fans is going to be actually what the Sixers get back. I think they're going to get a pretty good package in whatever the Simmons deal is, either if it's a two-team deal, a three-way deal where they get like a morass of assets and that then get traded somewhere else. I think overall Sixers fans are going to be happy with whatever the trade is.
Yeah, the one thing I've noticed as this saga has gone on is that the overall attitude about the trade has changed significantly. When it first started, and I think a lot of it was reactionary because of the way the Sixers had fallen out of the playoffs. At first, it kind of seemed like trade him for whatever you can get. Like, his value is so low, you're not going to be able to get anything for him anyway. Just trade the best package you can get, regardless of what it is. Public opinion has seemed to have flipped a little bit on him, and I think there are people out there believe we are going to get a lot better of a package than we may have expected going into it. I always thought that we were going to get a decent package. I thought his value was still going to be there in the NBA trade market, regardless of what we had seen. I'm excited to see what they end up pulling the trigger on. I saw a few rumors. There was one talking about Sacramento, that they would not trade De'Aaron Fox for Ben Simmons. Where do you fall on the potential for a Kings trade? Like, what do you think it would look like? And what do you think it would mean for the Sixers?
I mean, I'm not surprised that they wouldn't be able to trade Fox. Fox definitely has, I think, more trade value around the league than Simmons. And I also think that the Kings, just going from Fox, a guard who's elite in transition and can sort of shoot, to Simmons, a guard who's elite in transition but cannot shoot at all, I think kind of doesn't make sense functionally. But I still think that getting a bunch of stuff from the Kings, like Tyrese Haliburton, for example — I love Tyrese Haliburton. I think he'd be so fun here. Getting him, potentially the number nine pick that they can flip somewhere else, and some sort of other salary, maybe Harrison Barnes, DeLon Wright, something like that. If it's just Sixers Kings, like one for one, I think that would be fine. Or Buddy Hield, if you're into that depends. I know Ken's a big Buddy Hield guy, but I think he's beauty in the eye of the beholder, same as Simmons. So it's really, I would be shocked if it's Simmons for Fox, but I think we could all be happy if that were the case.
How full circle would it be if we ended up trading Ben Simmons in a package that got the Sixers Buddy Hield? Could you imagine? That would be like my day of reckoning.
This For the listeners who are unaware, back in 2016, Kenny was arguing for the Sixers to draft Buddy Hield number one overall. I was strongly against it, but I wouldn't say I was very right on the issue either, because I thought Ingram was not going to be that good. He's obviously very good. So I think that would just be a shit show.
Yeah, no, that would be a complex deal. Is there a trade out there right now, maybe a rumor you've heard, maybe an idea you've had that you like, you think is realistic? You know, what are you thinking?
So the five teams that have been most linked are the Kings, Timberwolves, Pacers, Cavaliers, and I'm forgetting one. Doesn't matter. But I think the Kings can put who? The Warriors have been linked, but they don't have anything that's appealing to the Sixers, really. I can't think of anything. The Raptors. I mean, I guess the Kyle Lowry sign and trade, but that's, you know, the value's not there. The only thing is if the Cavaliers are willing to give up the number three pick, and then the Sixers can reroute that for, say, Bradley Beal, that would be, I think, the best way to go about it. But I don't think the Cavs are willing to do that.
I saw a trade the other day. And this is all just, you know, NBA fans throwing stuff out there. But I saw a three-team deal with the Sixers, Timberwolves, and Wizards that saw Ben Simmons going to the Timberwolves, George Hill and Anthony Edwards going to the Wizards, and Bradley Beal and Ricky Rubio to the Sixers.
I think I saw this too. Let's see, the Timberwolves give up Edwards and Rubio for Simmons, which I think that's a loss for them. But, I mean, Edwards is really the best, like, trade asset they can dangle at the moment. Beal for Edwards, that's fair. Simmons and Hill for – I think the Sixers get away with murder there.
I agree.
Yeah, I think that's a steal.
I think pretty much any trade in which they get Bradley Beal and keep – one of Maxi Matisse is obviously highway murder. Like that would be a complete win on all fronts. But yeah, I mean, you know, right now we really don't know anything. There's nothing but rumors at this point. And until there is a trade made, that's all it's going to be. If you had to predict right now, will Ben Simmons be on the roster on opening night for the Sixers?
Absolutely not. Like, the odds have to be minus 15,000 at this point for him to not be on the roster.
All right. That's interesting. I mean, I agree with you, but I definitely have seen some of the conversation shift to thinking that he's going to be back and they're going to make a move in season or something. I don't know. We will obviously see what happens with Simmons.
Would you like it? I mean, would you be comfortable with Simmons being back on the roster next year?
I would rather them make the trade now. You know, I think the magnitude of the trade is going to require, like, is going to require a lot of time for those players to get assimilated to each other and get assimilated to the offensive systems. Whoever it is, they have to figure out how to play with that new player coming in, especially considering they've played with such a unique fit of a player for the past few years, Ben Simmons. So I'd rather them not try to do something in season and kind of cap the ceiling of whatever that new unit could be. But I would agree with you. I think he's likely gone. So, well, I mean, we just have to wait and see. It's going to be an all summer thing. I don't think we're any closer to it happening, but you know, the wheels have started to turn and everybody seems to have an opinion on it.
Yeah. That's why we pushed this segment to the end of the episode, because we're going to be doing this all summer.
Yeah. Every single episode is likely going to have a Simmons check-in, even if it's just like a still nothing today, that type of thing. Like we're obligated to mention it at this point. It's very, very relevant in our lives. So we'll see what ends up happening.
We will see, just like with the prospects, just like with the trades the Phillies could potentially make, just like with the union coming up soon. No, I'm just kidding. I don't know what's going on with that.
We did get a question. Let's do it then. We did get a question in the mailbag from Birdo Joe. You all know Birdo. He said, "What would it take to get the average 4-for-4 fan into the union?" My take is a global pandemic and all of the sports being canceled. And I mean that in the least disrespectful way possible. I got really, really, really into the Union last summer when they had the return to MLS tournament, and it was the only thing that was on. I admittedly am not a soccer guy. I like watching, you know, international play, that kind of stuff. I like playing soccer. I don't watch it. But them being a Philadelphia team and not competing with other major sports definitely aided in being able to be invested. So I think you know, another COVID might do it for people.
I think getting people to like soccer in general. I mean, if you look at how popular basketball's become recently, and how much foul drawing and flopping has become a central part of the NBA. I mean, just look at any soccer game that ever happens. Flopping is all over the place. So if people are mildly entertained by basketball in that way, I think soccer could be entertaining. And for the most part, fans do not want to get up at like 7 a.m. to watch a Premier League game or a European League game of any sort. So maybe them watching a primetime game down in Chester will down at what's it called now? PPL Park? No, that's the old
name. No, I think that's it, right?
Is it this is bad. This is really bad.
I think it's PPL, right? I don't know. I don't pretend to know. I think that sounds right to me. I think another thing they would do, it would be increased coverage. If they covered the Union like they covered the other four teams, well, I guess I should say other three teams, because the Flyers kind of get left out too. That would play a large part in it. But I mean, I think it would be a blast if Philadelphia became some inkling of a soccer city, because the games would just be madness and entertaining to go to. So yeah, I mean, it's just a matter of people being into soccer.
Yeah, I think them playing in outside of Philly also doesn't help. Also, the park is called Subaru Park now. It has gone through five name changes since the Union were created. But yeah, I think if they played in Philly more often, I know they play at least like one game a year at Lincoln Financial Field, but it doesn't always go well, and it usually destroys the grass before an Eagles game. But I think maybe making that transition to Philly might attract more fans.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's also a good point. It's a shame, because from what I understand, the Union are pretty good. But we'll see. I mean, maybe we should do our part and do a Union segment of the week. I have to consider throwing that in there. But that's pretty much all I have to say this week. We got a lot out there. A lot of rambling too. Especially considering we that was probably the most we've talked about the Union in 34 episodes that we've done this podcast for. Do you have anything else you have to say?
Yeah, episode 35, we'll have a soul segment. And then episode 36, the wings, I think we'll touch on. But no, I think next time we talk to you, there will be a very fun guest that I think you'll all be happy to listen to.
That is true. Maybe probably our biggest guest in the history of the pod. That's all we'll say. We're not going to spoil it. But yeah, no, very exciting guests coming up. Get excited, rightfully so, you should be. And then, you know, also look forward to our in memoriam for the Wings and the Soul. I actually went to a Wings game and it was a lot of fun. They just played like heavy metal music the whole time. But it was entertaining. That's going to do it for episode 34 of the podcast. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, at Something Philly. Follow me at Ken the Ben. Follow Alec at Alec NBA. Phillies come back on Friday. The Sixers trade Ben Simmons at some point. And that's pretty much all we got left. We will talk to you guys next week. Alec, give us something positive to go into the rest of the week.
Simmons trade happens in the next 3 weeks. Okay. Before the draft.
Okay. When is the draft again?
I believe it is July 29th, so 2 weeks.
We are going to go with it. Okay, the clock is ticking, Daryl. Let's see what you got. That'll do it for us this week. We'll talk to you guys soon.